Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Hello once again, friends, and welcome to episode number 33 of the Fergan podcast. Here we're going to be continuing our exploration of the themes of my short story, Fire in the White Stone. And once again, I'm joined by fellow traveller, Adam, who helped with the first part of this two-part series, this two-part exploration. When we did part one, we didn't know how long it was going to take. So, I think we ended up doing about 2 hours on about the first half of the book, really. So we thought it best to cut it there and save the rest for another part. So I don't think that I need to introduce either myself or Adam, because I can't imagine that anyone listening to this won't have listened to the first part. We're going to start with a bit of a recap. One thing I will say is that, again, this is full of spoilers. So if anyone does happen to have landed upon this episode without having listened to number 32, and you don't want the story to be spoiled, if you're planning to read Fire in the White Stone at some point, then please don't listen any further, because this is full-on spoilers, yeah, in this discussion. So I gather that, Adam, that you're probably quite pleased to have episode number 33. I know that numerological significances are important to you. So, how are you doing, Adam?
Yeah, doing great. Thanks. Yeah, it's great to be back and to continue discussing the book.
Yeah, great. And 33 is an important number esoterically. You know, we have... many people know that 33 is important in Freemasonry. You have the 33 levels of Freemasonry, and even though, speaking for myself certainly, and I'm sure speaking for Adam as well, we're not in favor of Freemasonry. However, Freemasonry does base a lot of its esoteric ideas on much older, more established ones, and the number 33 is significant in it being the number of vertebrae in the spine. I believe that the Freemasons base it on the fact that Jesus Christ was 33 years old when he died. Is that correct, Adam? Or?
Yeah, that's correct. Roughly about that age anyway, or they at least cooked the books in order to make him that age at which he was crucified.
Exactly, yeah. You, depending on how you look at it, you know, obviously I'm not a Christian, neither is Adam, but... You know, I think that the Bible took a lot of pre-existing esoteric occult knowledge and encoded it within its texts. So these are, as I say, these are older themes. Yes, Adam and I are going to be continuing. I'll give a very brief recap on the story so far. And then there are a couple of things that we wanted to pick up on from part one, the section of story that we covered in part one. Some of the symbols and themes which we didn't cover properly, which we just want to pick up on in this. So with the story so far, we have the protagonist who we find out later in the story is known by the name Nook. He's a fairly average man living in a young man living in a kind of, a very, I don't know, mundane town called Modersley. He's married, but he feels compelled to depart from the town. He doesn't know why or where. He goes. He takes a leather cloak that he creates from a bull that dies at the beginning of the story. He wanders off into the woods. He hears the call of voices upon the wind. He encounters a wild hunt. He encounters various symbols. He encounters a strange, mysterious, elderly man called Larstance, who knows him by name, knows Nook by name, who, and this character Larstance inexplicably pushes Nook into a torrential river. And that's where we got to in the last episode. So one thing that we wanted to pick up on is this, the idea surrounding Larstance as this very kind of playful yet deadly serious character, that this kind of, as I believe Adam called in, him in the last episode, was it the wizard at the threshold or the wizard at the door?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, so the wizard at the door, you know, it's a very obvious archetype, the, you know, Gandalf and the character who comes and compels the lead character to go on his adventure. And that's basically what Larstance is in this story. But there is a playful aspect to him, and this ties into the archetype of the Fool. And I think this is something that Adam probably knows a bit more about than I do. So I'm going to hand this over to Adam at this point, and we'll just talk a little bit about the Fool, which I believe is common. It's a card in the tarot deck. And, you know, it is a very, very old archetype. So, Adam, if you want to talk a bit about that.
Sure. So, I mean, at the beginning of Nook's adventure, we could very much see him as being the embodiment of the Fool card in Tarot. So, the Fool is card zero of the 22 cards that make up the what's called the Major Arcana. These are like 22 cards which are unique additions to the standard deck of cards with the, you know, your conventional hearts, clubs, spades, etc., those various different suits. But these 22 major arcana cards are all very powerful archetypes. Like, you've got stuff like the Hanging Man, the Tower, the Sun, the Moon, the Lovers, etc. So the Fool card actually has, it plays with a lot of dualism and this tension between dualism, even the number of the card itself being zero. So the kind of the zero shape, simultaneously represents emptiness, but also wholeness as well. And this particular idea of this kind of tension between the dualism, it's echoed within many different occult systems. For instance, within Kabbalah, there's this concept of this within the tree of life, the lowest Sephiroth is called Malkuth, but within that, the lowest, it also has the potential to reach the highest. It's this kind of within, there's an occult maxim within Hermeticism, which is as above, so below, and in Kabbalah, it's Kepher is in Malkuth, and Malkuth is in Kepher. So the Fool card itself is all about new beginnings, and for anyone who's unfamiliar with the card as well, it depicts a young man setting off an adventure, and just like Nook as well, he's carrying very little for his adventure, and he's oblivious to the possible dangers that may lie ahead, which on the Fool card is literally what seems to be that he's about to walk off a cliff. I mean, it's similar to how Nook is pushed into the waters by Larstance. And an interesting thing about that as well is Larstance tells Nook to look into the waters of the deep. He's like leaning over and he tells him to look. And those deep waters like symbolically represent the subconscious mind and the unknown. So by doing this, Larsent is effectively encouraging Nook to look into his own subconscious and effectively to make the subconscious conscious before he pushes him into the water.
Yeah, there is actually a lot that we can say on this, and a lot is coming to me right now as you're speaking, Adam, because the idea of the fall being both zero and completion, being nothing and completion at the same time, I think we get that in the in this idea of unlearning. So the fool doesn't have to unlearn anything before he can learn the truth, right? So in a sense, by being empty of knowledge, or having the ability to empty oneself of knowledge, you actually have more potential, because by being the fool, by being someone who lacks that knowledge, either through never having had it or being able to be rid of the knowledge that you have, you then open yourself up to the full breadth of real truth. Is that ever kind of spoken of as being one of the symbolic meanings of the fall in the tarot tradition?
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, I mean, we even kind of have this idea that kind of echoes through today, where people will say, you know, oh, beginner's luck, right? And it's quite a common thing, really. But yeah, it's certainly equated to that idea is certainly equated to the fall within tarot.
Yeah, and over the last few years, you know, with so many people who are well-educated scientists, you know, with degrees and things, buying into the lies of the establishment, I think we've seen demonstrations of this concept, really. Whereas it's the fool, the person who is able and willing to step outside of mainstream society, who would be deemed by mainstream society as the fool, is actually the wisest one, or certainly the one who has the capability to become wise, because they are able to think for themselves away from the pack, you know, separate from the mainstream establishment. And, you know, this Larsent in this story is that hermit, that, you know, this is why the fool and the hermit are essentially the same character. The fool is depicted as a hermit in many traditions, because the hermit lives outside of society. They're seen as a fool by society, when actually they're often outside of society by virtue of understanding more than the average person does, or at least having the ability to think for themselves.
Yeah, that's interesting that you equate the fool with the hermit. So would you say that Larsent is like almost like an aspect of Nook in this instance?
Yeah, I suppose Nook is kind of the hermit or the fool in an earlier stage, at least at this point in the story, not knowing what his eventual destiny is going to be. That is kind of what he seems to be, someone who is withdrawing himself from society. And another aspect of this, which, you know, we can draw from the Germanic tradition, is that of the Mannebund. And Odin, or Woden, is the leader of the Mannebund. The Mannebund being, I believe, in other traditions, known as the Koryos, these youthful men who self-ostracize themselves from society and live outside of society as outlaws, and then are able to return to their society with a greater, martial prowess and understanding. And Odin is the leader of them. And it's, again, it's that ability to, the importance of being of self-ostracizing oneself from society is that you are then able to appraise the society that you came from an outsider perspective. So when you're within something, when you're within a group or a society, you have this kind of bias, you have these blinkers, you can only see things from within. When you step outside of it, then you get a much more objective view of that society, both its strengths and its flaws. And these young men, I believe that this is one of the important aspects of the Mannebund, was the ability to judge the society and see what's weak about it from the outside, and then to return to it, bringing that knowledge back with you to strengthen the society from within.
Yeah, that's very much like the role of the shaman as well, who is somewhat kind of on the outskirts of society or outside of it entirely, and is able to kind of observe it from the outside, go into the unknown and then bring something back. So that idea is echoed there as well.
Yeah, essentially the shaman is the fool, is the hermit, is the wise god, is the wizard at the door. These archetypes or entities all tie in with one another. So Adam and I felt that was an important thing to kind of go back over. Unless you've got anything further to say on that, Adam, I believe there was something that you brought up regarding collarbones.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I do have a little bit more on the fool.
Yeah, please. Yeah, let's go fully into that.
Yeah, so I'm just got the card in front of me, actually. So in his hand as well, he carries a white rose, which represents his innocence and his purity of heart. And really, one of the things that the Fool card is about following your own heart, even if it might seem foolish at first. And when you get the Fool card in a reading, it tends to be a reminder that we have the power to shape our own destiny, and you know, to have that kind of courage to step forth into the unknown. And as you know from my ongoing investigation into the Grail mythos, there's a connection between Parsifal of the Arthurian legends and the Fool card, as Parsifal is quite literally a pure fool. Due to his intentionally sheltered upbringing by his mother. So there's a connection as well here between Parsifal's mother and also him obviously living in Modisley, which, as we mentioned last time, translates to mother's field.
Right, yeah.
And there's another connection as well with the fool, and the fool representing the start of the hero's journey. So the fool card is connected with the element of air, which, as I mentioned last time, that there's a great deal of air and wind imagery at the point where Nook sets off on his adventure. And as well, the card is associated with the planet of Uranus, which is a revolutionary energy. But when it comes to the Fool, it isn't necessarily about overthrowing of the social order, but really a revolution of individual consciousness.
Right.
So we can jump onto the collarbones now, unless you wanted to comment.
No, that's fascinating. I mean, I'm not very knowledgeable about the tarot. I do, many years ago, I can't remember whether I bought it for myself or someone bought it as a gift, but I have quite a nice tarot set, but I've never used it. I've always been kind of fascinated with it, but I did pick that up when I was less involved with heathenry, and then the runes took over, and the runes are the same thing. They serve the same purpose as the tarot, but just in a different tradition. So I wasn't aware of the image of the fool with the white rose symbolizing purity, but that really does tie everything together. It's that ability to go out with a clean slate. And in some ways, the man who is able to go out with a clean slate and fill it or allow it to be filled has the greatest capacity for wisdom and potential.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
As for those the collarbones that you mentioned, as we were talking about how the more I began to kind of look into elements of the story, it almost was like a fractal pattern. Like the deeper I kind of looked into it, the more and more things that I found. And I mentioned to you about this opening line that you have of chapter 3, which is a burst of chill beneath the collarbones. So the collarbones are also called the clavicle, which comes from the word clav, which means key, and then the suffix ickle, which means small. So therefore, clavicle, it means small key. And in Ayurvedic or systems of holistic medicine, the clavicle is associated. Problems with the clavicle tend to be associated with people who are having difficulties in discovering the key to a question, and it can also indicate that the person's suffering from problems in a relationship. where they feel they're unable to assert themselves, which is essentially kind of what we're seeing with Nook, with his various different relationships in Modusly, even his relationship with his wife, as he nods in agreement with his wife when he brings up the idea of confronting the, I think it's the town council, about the exploitation of Nook's labor as a stonemason. And she kind of dismisses this, that this would be a foolish idea. And so it's said that someone with this particular ailment can't live a straightforward life. And the cure to this particular ailment is to travel and then eventually return to resolve this complication.
Yeah, and when you brought this up after we recorded part one of this exploration, I was fascinated. I mean, again, this is something that I had. There was no intention behind that. There was nothing deliberate about the line involving collarbones. It was just, to me, it was just an attempt at being expressive and poetic, really, about how one would feel being out in the middle of the night in these cold, wild woods. And, you know, where you would feel the cold and the discomfort of being in that place. And, you know, the idea of being, you know, a chill of wind beneath the collarbones came up. I mean, the other interesting thing is that a nook is a small space, right? So how would you unlock a small space? Well, with a small key, you know, so it does seem to be another little tie in there.
Oh, yeah, I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, right. So, so that's kind of us up to date with the story, really, for everything we covered in part one. And the story continues with Nook being swept along this torrential river, which I do kind of almost personify as a serpent. And this kind of comes from the idea, and there was something deliberate to this. This comes from the idea of the serpent being a bringer of wisdom, which is an aspect of many ancient traditions. So this bringer of wisdom bringing Nook to a place of greater wisdom. And when Nook arrives, when he wakes up from unconsciousness, having almost been drowned in this river, and he's been swept along, he has no idea how far he's been taken. And the line in the story is, you know, how far had the river taken him? And that is both, you know, geographically how far, physically how far has the river taken him, but also psychologically and spiritually how far has the river taken him. And this is really the threshold of the story. This is the Lagu's portion of the story. And I mentioned in part one of the conversation about how the story is structured around the Alu-Ula runic formula, this alchemical formula of stagnation, then change, and then attaining higher understanding or a greater sense of spirituality or achievement. And this is the Lagu's portion, this is why I wrote the river into the story, to represent Lagu's, which is the flowing waters, these waters of change. So Nook ends up at Gar's Edge, which is an area of the map, an area of the fictional land where the story is set. Now, I think Adam has a couple of things to say about Gar's Edge, but I just want to mention that the name Gar's Edge comes from, I'd come across this old English, this Anglo-Saxon word, Gar's Edge, meaning ocean, or the edge of the ocean, as I understood it to be at the time. This is many years ago, and it was just a very kind of fleeting glimpse at a word that I'd come across. So I decided to take that and just change the phrasing of it slightly to Gar's Edge. Now, that does have a double meaning, because in runic language, Gar is spear. The Gar rune is the spear rune. What I didn't realize at the time is that, and you'll have to remind me here, Adam, but Gar's Edge actually does have another meaning other than ocean. Doesn't it mean spear-wielding hero or hero or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's correct. Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up, actually. And also, you mentioned this as well, how the journey that he's been on in terms of like physical geography, but also the kind of that psychic journey as well. So I very much saw this Gar's Edge, this kind of like threshold, is that he's kind of been psychologically taken to his kind of limit at that point. And yeah, we'd mentioned how, I'd mentioned as well last time how Gar's Edge potentially connected with the Spear of Destiny, which Nook is really kind of, you know, he's just about starting to understand this at this point. This is the kind of the beginning of that particular aspect of the journey.
Yeah, and this is, we touched upon this in part one, but the overall kind of symbology of Nook is that he is a spear, that he is being wielded by higher powers. And it's not so much present in the short story itself, but in the lyrics for the album which accompany it, by My Project Walkensman, the song Sprig to Spear, which is a song later in the album, one of the kind of climactic lyrics of that song is, as a spear, I am thread through the woven darkness, gift of Gar. So it's this idea that Nook realizes that he is a spear being wielded by higher powers. He is being thrust into the darkness. He is Gar. And I had no idea about this when I wrote the story. I swear to the gods that Gar's Edge also means a spearman or a spear wielding warrior. Yeah, spearman. And I this is just another serendipitous thing which came about through the writing of the story. I had no idea. As far as I was aware, when I wrote the story, Gar's Edge just meant ocean. It didn't mean anything other than that, but it has a double meaning in Old English of ocean and spearman. Nook, after being pushed into the river, ends up at the land called Gar's Edge, where soon after he realizes that he himself is the Gar, the spear that is being thrust into that eventuality.
Yeah, incredible how many of these there are within the story, these unconscious elements, intentional perhaps, but maybe not consciously intentional, that have found their way into the story. Yeah, yet another example there.
Yeah, so I think from there we can move on to the swans. And just to introduce this idea, I talked a lot about the swans in my podcast episode about divine encounters, because one of my, what I believe to be divine encounters was a very vivid dream I had in early 2013. and it was a very, very vivid dream about traveling in or being on some kind of quest in a land of ice and snow, this frozen landscape. I don't know where this came from, but I reached a pond where there were two giant swans floating in the pond, and they had their beaks kind of frozen shut by ice. So they weren't able to communicate with me. I sensed that they were sentient beings, that they were able to communicate in a human manner, but they weren't physically able to communicate because of having their beaks frozen. But one of the swans came over to me and did communicate to me kind of telepathically in the dream. and implored me to seek a way to free their beaks. So, you know, long story short, some sort of short quest, which then enabled me to free their beaks of ice. And then they were content and they were able to, you know, go about their ways. And that was the dream that I had. And it was one of those dreams where you wake up and you just, you know that there's something deeper to it. It comes out of nowhere and you know that there's something profound there. And, you know, I think many of the people listening to this have probably had experiences of dreams like that. And the interesting thing is that it was later that year in 2013 that I recorded the first Walkensman demo. Looking back on it now, I kind of realized that, you know, and when I started the Walkensman project, I wasn't a singer and I had no intention of being a singer. I actually didn't think that I really had a particularly good ability to sing. But when I came to record the demo, I didn't know anyone who was interested in that style of music and could sing it in the way that it needed to be sung. So I just had a go at doing it myself. And it feels like, looking back on it now, that one of the meanings of the dream I had was this idea of freeing up your ability to speak or sing, and on both an individual level, on maybe on a wider societal level and things like that. But anyway, when I came to write Fire in the White Stone, this was one of the symbolisms that I wanted to resurrect or include in the story. So I wrote these swans that I'd encountered in my dream into the story. And this is the chapter of the story, Swans of the Gar's Edge, of which there is also a song by the same name on the accompanying album. So the swans is a very, very interesting symbol in Indo-European lore. Adam, what is your, I mean, what you have some thoughts on this, I'm sure. Before I kind of get into my understanding of the swan and its symbolism, what do you make of that?
Sure. Well, I had so much to comment on what you were saying there. I mean, it's incredible that dream that you had just kind of inspired this entire process. And you do know when you have one of those dreams as well, that it's kind of that has real kind of significance. It seems to kind of just reoccur to you over and over again until you kind of resolve the aspects of that dream. And in terms of the swans, you know, finding a way to thaw out the ice that was binding those swans' mouths as well, you've most certainly kind of found your voice in your music, and most certainly in the kind of wider kind of societal level as well. I mean, I very much admired you speaking out during, you know, the past 3 years, and that's one of the things that really brought me to your channel and your content.
Thank you, Adam. Yeah.
So as for the swans, so when you're reading the auguries, which is the practice of, I guess, kind of foretelling events based upon signs and omens, swans are symbolic of fortune, dignity, feminine intuition, and they tend to be seen as being spirit messengers, and they can indicate a surprising turn of events, and in particularly the concept of a blessing in disguise, or when something is presented as an obstacle, but it later reveals itself to be something that's actually happening in your favor, which is actually something that occurs within the story, where Nook recontextualizes him being pushed into the river by Larsent as he realizes that this is exactly what needed to happen at that particular time.
Yeah. In European superstition, British superstition, I can't really speak more widely than that, but I expect it's the same. Birds tend to symbolize the souls of loved ones, of ancestors. So, for example, a robin, the death of a robin is quite a bad omen, superstitiously, because a robin coming near to you is a visitation by an ancestor, by a spirit, and the death of one is a bad omen, you know, for that reason. So a swan is obviously a much larger bird, but it is a bird nevertheless. So it is part of that same symbolic area, that same train of thought. In Germanic tradition, we have the rune Algis. The rune Algis is generally accepted to mean protection. This is the kind of esoteric understanding that many, you know, for example, Edred Thorsen and his book, Futhark, is the first rune book that I ever bought. And if you read his book, the esoteric interpretation that he gives of the Algis rune is the Valkyries. The Valkyries being kind of another representation of the Fylgja, or the Fetch, the higher self, the spirit that watches over you. So the Algis rune is the rune of protection. In a literal sense, the shape of the rune kind of looks like the antlers of a stag. And in the old English rune poem, the rune poem goes as follows. Algis, which is Elksedge in the English rune row, which means elk grass. So elk grass most often dwells in a fen, grows in water, harshly wounds, marks with blood any warrior who tries to take it. So even though that's quite abstract and somewhat different from the idea of the stag and of the Valkyrie, it nevertheless does represent protection. So on a spiritual level, Algis is the rune of spiritual protection, the protection of higher spirits or higher selves, the Fylgja, the like the guardian spirit. And this ties into the idea of the Valkyries who collect the dead, the slain upon the battlefield and take them either to Valhalla or to Folkvang, one of the halls of the slain. But what's very interesting about, there is also, you can also look at the shape of the Algis rune and it looks like a swan with its wings raised. And the swan, of course, is a bird which is very much known for being an extremely protective creature. You know, you get anywhere near a swan's young and it's a particularly violent animal, a very, very protective animal. So the Algis rune tends to be accepted either as a representation of the stag or the swan, but either way, it's represents protection, particularly spiritual protection. And the swan being a white bird, that indicates the spiritual nature of the swan. So it indicates, it points us towards the fact that it is spiritual protection. Now, in the continental Germanic tradition, there is a this idea of the Alkis. So rather than the Algis, the Alkis, A-L-C-I-S, or Alki. I don't know if I'm pronouncing those words properly. I think it's Alkis rather than Alsis. But obviously the name is very similar to Algis. But the Alkis in Proto-Germanic tradition were a pair of divine brothers. So my dream and my inclusion of the swans, these two swans, seems to, and you know, this is information which I wasn't fully aware of when I had the dream or when I wrote the story necessarily. There is this tie, this concept of twins, which does tie into the idea of the swans, which ties into protection. Apparent esoteric understanding of Algis is the idea of a grand plan. It's a connection to a grand plan, a divine plan that you may be unaware of, a protective teaching force. Some analysts will talk about. So these swans, the swans of Gar's Edge, they are an encouragement towards this higher divine plan. They are these twins, these protective spiritual twins who are looking out for the character of Nook. And I guess, you know, I could say that they, you know, because I was given that dream, they were looking out for me. They were encouraging me towards playing a part in a grander plan of things. So I wrote that into the story as them encouraging Nook in his pursuit of this grand plan without really knowing what it is. And when he wakes up after this Lagus period of the story, the torrential, being swept along by this torrential river, the moment of change, this moment of transformation, when he enters that new world symbolically, the first thing he is greeted by are these otherworldly spirits, these guardian spirits, so to speak. So yeah, Adam, over to you.
Sure. I mean, it's very interesting that you mentioned the connection between the swans and spiritual protection from a higher kind of spiritual force. As I mentioned, when we were talking about Nook being pushed into the deep, into the waters, the waters below the deep essentially represents the subconscious. And now, if you think about the pure white of the snow of the swan, sorry, as it effortlessly glides across the water, this is symbolically equated with the dawn of consciousness, or pure consciousness itself, without the subconscious being disturbed as they kind of smoothly glide across the water. So the swan's confrontation with Nook is essentially his higher mind communicating with his lower mind at that point, I would say.
That's very interesting. And you've just reminded me as well, is that both in my dream and in the story, one or both of the swans are angry at Nook, and he doesn't understand why. And this was my experience in the dream as well. You know, when I had the dream, I first encountered these swans, they had their beaks, you know, bound shut by ice, and they were angry at me as though it was my fault. And I didn't know why, but I nevertheless knew that it was my task, my calling to free their beaks. And it's the same in this story. It's that idea of when you don't, and this is the same thing as with Larsen's pushing Nook into the river. He doesn't understand why someone would do that to him at the time. And it only becomes apparent later on why these things. It's that tough love thing coming in again. And it's the tough love of the swans, this kind of anger that they have because Nook is not fulfilling his part of the divine plan, and they're angry at him. But because Nook doesn't even know that he's part of the divine plan, he doesn't understand why they're angry at him, why they're kind of being acting in this forceful manner. And it's because they understand that there's a plan, but Nook doesn't, and they're frustrated with him that he's not playing his role. So yeah, I think that pretty much covers the swans. I mean, there's probably a lot more we could say, and maybe Adam does have something else to add, but for my part, I think that about covers it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the swans as well, in Greco-Roman mythology, they're associated with Apollo, the sun god, you know, reflecting solar consciousness. So yeah. Apollo is often depicted as riding with swans in his chariot, and there's also coins of Apollo which have a swan on the reverse of the coin, and Apollo is the god of archery. So it's interesting as well that links with the as I mentioned in the first episode, that this the adventure takes place at the end of November, which is Sagittarius, and Sagittarius is symbolically depicted as the archer, and this is kind of the at least the kind of beginning of when, you know, we're at Gar's edge, the spear's edge. This is where Nook gets the I guess after this encounter, he begins to kind of realize that he's being aimed or flung towards his destiny. As well, Apollo has nine muses who are the source of inspiration for poetry and music. So I guess this kind of links with the symbolism of your dream and the swans with their mouths frozen shut, and you finding your voice and inspiration for the music.
Yeah, I think one of the lessons of this is that, you know, if you do believe in a grand plan that we're all part of, is that playing your role in that can sometimes be as simple as opening your mouth and speaking up. You know, I'm not special in that sense. Anyone has the ability to do that. It's just finding the impetus, the encouragement to do that, speaking up. And it you know, it could just be one area of expertise that you are particularly passionate about, that you've been keeping quiet about because you either feel that you don't, you lack the confidence to speak about it, or you don't feel like anyone would be interested in what you've got to say, or whatever. But actually, you just need to start talking, and you find that just your words, your voice, whether it be spoken word or sung words, can open a lot of doorways for you. So whatever your talent, whatever you have the ability to speak about, you should be speaking about. No one should be keeping their mouth shut on something that they have to offer the world. That's kind of how I interpret this area of the story and of my experience with all of this.
Yeah, I'd certainly echo that sentiment. It can be very difficult to find your own voice, though, sometimes, and it certainly takes courage to speak out, you know, so...
Yeah, that's where the tough love thing comes in. You know, sometimes you need to be forced, you need to be compelled to do these things. You need to be pushed into an uncomfortable position where you have no choice but to speak up and offer the world what, you know, that which you can. But isn't there something, you're more familiar with the Grail mythos than I am, isn't there something to do with swans, connection between Parsifal and the swans, or...
Oh, yes. So, yes. So the Swan Knight of the Arthurian legends, who's called Lohengrin. He's the son of Parsifal, and he's featured towards the end of the Wolfram von Eschenbach's version of Parsifal.
Right, so that's the Swans of Gar's Edge kind of dealt with, I guess, as they do get dealt with in the story, in a loving manner by the end of it. Then we move on to there are some voices on the wind again, and this is something that Nook encounters earlier in the story, in which Adam and I spoke about in the first part of this exploration. These voices which are compelling you onwards in your destiny, in your journey, the hearing the call, you know, of the gods or of destiny or of Weird, the sisters of Weird, the three sisters, you know, weaving your fate and hearing this kind of this subtle call upon the wind, where you're not entirely sure that you've heard it, but it's there and it just gives you that bit of confidence. But at this point in the story, the maidens do actually appear. Nook, he is lying on the shore of Gar's Edge after being chided by the swan, by one of the swans, and then he loses consciousness again, and he is carried by some mysterious ghostly maidens, the maidens of the Rhymeland, as they're called in the story. And he never really interacts with them. He actually hears about the event of having been carried by these maidens from the shores of Gar's Edge to the cave where these strange dwarven characters dwell. He hears about that from the dwarves. So he awakens in the cave of the dwarves and is told that he was carried there by these mysterious ghostly maidens. And in the book, I wrote a poem to account for that section of the story, for the part of the maidens. So I was trying to, rather than use prose, I was trying to use poetry, because poetry to me is a more ghostly form of prose, if you see what I mean. It's a more artistic, musical form of language. And that to me seemed fitting as a way of representing these ghostly, musical, mysterious maidens who we find out that have carried Nook to the next section of his journey. I think Adam has something to mention here regarding fire.
Yeah, sure. So the chapter opens obviously with your poem about the three maidens, or the Norns, or the weird sisters who weave the web of weird. But yeah, the chapter after the poem opens with a new element being introduced. Now, if you remember from the previous episode, we begin the story with very rich earth symbolism, with Furrows the Bull. And then when Nook embarks on his quest, we have lots of wind and lots of air in the forms of whooshing winds. And then we have Larstence, who pushes Nook into the river, which is obviously water. And now we're at, he awakes next to a fire. So now we're at fire. So he's moved from the element of air to the element of, from earth to air to water, and now to fire. So what we're actually doing there is we're moving through the oppositional elements, as earth in terms of its symbol and its nature is the opposite of air. And now we're at fire, which is the opposite of the previous element that we encountered, which is water. So this kind of process of moving through opposites and the integration of opposites is a very alchemical concept, such as with the alchemical wedding, which is the sacred union of the masculine and feminine aspects. And nothing to do with androgyny, as it's, I think often these alchemical symbols are sometimes taken literally in that sense. I mean, I don't think the alchemists literally had a dragon in a, that it was using as the bellows. But yeah, so so fire is a masculine symbol, and that's represented as the upward facing triangle, the opposite of water, which is a downward facing triangle. An easy way to remember the alchemical symbols in this instance is to remember that water always goes down and fire always goes up. So so fire is associated with obviously light, warmth, protection, rebirth and purification. And fire has this capacity to both destroy and also to create. And it's obviously, you have an association with the phoenix, which is connected to concepts of death and rebirth, as the phoenix is reborn from its, when it bursts into flames, and it's reborn in that sense.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny how these things work very naturally, because the reason that Nook is by a fire is because he was frozen in the previous, you know, part of the story. So obviously the natural thing is that fire would resurrect him. But as you mentioned there with the phoenix, the fire resurrects on a more kind of philosophical level as well. So even though I didn't intend any of these essential elements, I didn't mean to write them into the story. They kind of wrote themselves into the story because of what happens to the character. And it just goes to show that connection between the material and the spiritual, in the things that you need materially are symbolic of the things that you need spiritually. And that is definitely the case through the course of this story. The other thing is that these dwarves, which Nook finds himself amongst in this cave, actually have forged his first weapon for him. And obviously they would have needed fire to do that. So the element of fire also represents that kind of final stage of forging something necessary for the completion of the task.
Well, yeah, and the connection as well here with fire is that that symbol of the up facing triangle, which is the symbol of the element of fire, is also the ancient archetypal symbol of the blade. And so it's certainly interesting that at this point is where Nook is presented with the sword.
Right. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. I didn't think of that. So the cave, I mean, this This was really heavily inspired by a scene in Brian Bates's The Way of Weird. This dreamlike section of the story. And I don't remember it in detail. It's been a very long time since I last read that book. But there's a scene where the character, I think he's called Brand, if I remember rightly, is dreams or imagines being beneath the ground where there are these dwarven characters. So it was my kind of take on that. And I've always been very fascinated and drawn to that. To that kind of I don't know, that vision, that idea of these kind of underground otherworldly characters working away whilst we're here living our mundane lives underground, whether in a kind of altered state of consciousness or even in a real state of consciousness, the idea that there are these otherworldly beings beneath the ground doing something, working away, creating something while we're here, and that we just need to encounter them. And in British fairy lore, the fairies pretty much represent the same thing. They are the same thing as the dwarves of, more Scandinavian lore. These underground entities, these strange, smaller creatures that live underground, and you can encounter them. You go into the barrow of the fairies or of the dwarves, and you know, obviously this ties into the idea of the barrow, the burial chamber, the barrow, this idea of being, of a human being buried in that otherworldly place. So this is what the cave is here. And I just love the kind of atmosphere that adds to the story. So that's why I put that in there. But these dwarves, and it's no secret that the names of the dwarves are representative of the four cardinal points, north, south, east, and west. The names of the dwarves I made up completely to be somewhat similar to the words north, south, east, and west. And this ties into what we know from the poetic Edda of the dwarves, who are similarly named and representative of the four cardinal points. There's not really much more to that I can speak about, unless Adam has maybe identified something, but there's nothing more that I intended for that to symbolize, really.
Sure. So as you mentioned, the dwarven names are, represent the four cardinal directions on the compass. And as I mentioned in the first episode, we discussed the significance of Nook heading east to begin his quest. And the east is associated with the element of air. And so each of the other directions are associated with the other elements, of course. North is earth, east is air, south is fire, and west is water. Interesting to note as well that Nook, when he encountered water, was traveled to the west. So what's interesting is that despite you not consciously putting these alchemical, at least the kind of elemental properties within the story, that was something that came through instinct, intuition, divine channeling, whatever it may be, is that at this point in the story, he encounters the embodiment of these four cardinal directions, that he's passed through these four elemental stages, and now he encounters the dwarves, which seem to represent all of these elements brought together as a single shared mind. And I say shared mind is because they literally finish one another's sentences. So the dwarves all together seem to embody or be this manifestation of all of these elemental symbols combined together.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I wrote that into the story just to kind of create something a bit more playful. Anyone who's ever tried writing a short story or a story, I think one of the challenges that you face is a way of creating dynamics throughout the story, points of interest, different moods throughout the story, and having characters talk in different ways and being descriptive of their surroundings is a way of doing that. So that's all I really intended to do at this point in the story, was to just kind of give, just to highlight the fact that these are different beings, that they are otherworldly beings, and that they behave in a different way, and that they are, I suppose in a sense I was kind of trying to get across the point that they are acting as a unit, that they are acting as one. But it's interesting, the idea that they represent the combining of the four elements, which is obviously something that I hadn't considered at all. And the combining of the four elements into this kind of completion, the completion that is required for the fulfillment of the task, that's pretty powerful symbology, I guess, which I didn't intend. But again, it's, you know, as we, Adam and I talked about in the part one of this exploration, it's, there are so many things which I didn't intend, which just came through me accidentally. And it just goes to show that these symbols, and, you know, the gods, or the ancestors, you know, whatever you believe, that they do speak through us, that we are kind of at certain times, we are a conduit for, these eternal truths.
Yeah, totally. I would, very much agree. Also, another aspect of this is that there's a concept within ceremonial magic called the Elemental Cross. And then this draws upon the mythical or mythological concept of the center of the world, the Axis Mundi, so to speak, which is depicted in a range of different ways within various different mythologies. The point where Nook is at this particular point in the journey, he with the four dwarves, which represent the four kind of cardinal directions, he is at the center point of the world at that point. He's in his cosmic center, so to speak. I mean, because the idea of standing in the center of the world is not necessarily a about geography, but more of a condition of consciousness itself. Although, of course, the choice of space that you enter can influence your consciousness as well. So
it's about stability, you know. And I wrote an article many years ago about one of the aspects of the article is the symbolism of the Philfot, or as many understand it, the swastika. This rotating symbol and the idea of being that it represents stability, stability of consciousness and spirit. Because if you are not at the center of that rotational force, then you are subject to the center of that rotational force. So when you find yourself at that center point, you are stable. You have found your feet. You know, and that obviously that's symbolically, either physically or philosophically. You have found where you're meant to be in the world, your point of influence, and all around you is influenced by the power that you now wield. Whereas if you are not at the center, you are being affected, you are being swept up by the turbulence, by the energy and the power of what is at the center of that. And that is, I believe, one of the most important, or if not the most important thing that the Philfot or the swastika represents.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it's such a powerful symbol.
And you know, when we talk about, you know, things like, you know, and not without passing any judgment on the Second World War one way or another, but I think one of the reasons that Hitler chose the swastika to represent was because he wanted to believe that he was in control of the destiny of the nation of Germany at last. So it was the idea that he or Germany came to be that center point of stability, that they were now determining what unfolds around them, rather than being having their ways determined for them by another center point.
Yeah, exactly. This idea, which is depicted within the swastika, and also like the elemental cross as well, depicts this too, is that the consciousness of the individual, or the kind of collective, or the group, or the nation, is standing at this kind of midpoint of the integration of all those four aspects, the four elemental aspects, in terms of consciousness. It's that kind of midpoint between every pair of opposites, and it's being, having the necessary consciousness to be in charge of your own destiny.
Yeah. Did you say, Adam, that the West is tied with water?
Yeah, that's correct.
Because the dwarves brew some spiced ale for Nook. And let me just read. Wessig's the finest brewer in the Rhineland. So Wessig, the dwarf named Wessig, obviously representative of West, is the brewer. Wessig West is the brewer of the ale. Completely accidental. Again, there was no understanding or intention behind that whatsoever, but it turns out that West is tied with water, i.e. liquid, therefore with the ale.
Fantastic. Yeah. I was wondering what this dwarven spice, I mean, it sounds delicious. I was wondering what the connection here was. Was it related to perhaps the mead of poetry, or, you know, that Odin gained strength from the drinking of the mead? What was your intention here with having the dwarven spiced ale?
Yeah, it is that. It's very much this ancient, timeless, archetypal myth of mead, the mead of inspiration, mead being something which inspires men to spiritual or physical greatness. But also, it was just a polite nod to the more conventional interpretation of alu, the runic formula alu, as ale. You know, this is most kind of academics who have ever touched upon the subject of the alu runic formula simply interpret it as meaning ale. It's something that I dispute. Not dispute, but I think it means it means so much more than simply ale. I think ale obviously can lead to intoxication, and a proper understanding of the alu-ula alchemical process can lead to intoxication in the same way. And I have a meditation based on this, which I've, I think I shared the exercise in my Patreon, Subscribestar and Substack for patrons, but it's a meditation which I developed inspired by a couple of other practices, which can lead to an almost intoxicated feeling. So I think that it does mean ale on a more basic literal sense. And it was just my nod to that. It was just my little kind of, as I say, my polite nod to the idea that alu simply means ale. That's really all there was to that.
Cool. I'll have to check out that meditation practice. Sounds very interesting.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. Yeah.
Cool.
From where are we from there? From the cave. So at this point, Nook, this is where, when he is given the sword by the dwarves, this small sword, this is when he realizes that he is being compelled onwards in this journey, and that he actually comes to understand that he is destined to do something, to face something, to use this weapon, even though he'd never set out with the intention to do that. So he starts making his way towards the back of the cave, to the darkness of the cave, and he sees himself lit up by the flames of the fire, which is more towards the front of the cave. He sees himself lit up as this kind of man of greater stature than he believes himself to be. And this is something I played on in the lyrics again. I can't recall the exact wording right now, but it's the idea that he's finally seeing himself as a man powerful enough to face whatever lies ahead. Whereas before, he only ever considered himself this kind of not particularly great and not particularly formidable or imposing young man from a nowhere town. Who had no particular purpose or task in life, and that he was just kind of tumbling down this rabbit hole that he didn't know where it ended. Whereas at this point, and this is where the song "Sprig to Spear" on the album comes in, the you know, going from a sprig to a spear, going from something small and relatively insignificant to something powerful and dangerous with purpose and meaning, where he becomes the spear. And this is the moment where he realizes that, and he moves into the back of the cave, and he goes to the next stage of his quest. And as Adam and I spoke about earlier in this episode, he is the gar, the spear, being wielded by a grander plan. And this is where he realizes that. So, this is, did you, Adam, did you want to mention something about the Four Hallows, or is that something we've covered already with the cardinal elements and the directions surrounding the elements? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of touched on this really, but yeah, I mean, this concept of the elemental cross, this kind of state of consciousness of in ceremonial magic. I mean, within the Grail mythos, this is called the inner castle of the Grail, and this is, you know, based around these emblems of the Four Hallows. But really, what I wanted to say here as well is, as I mentioned, the Fool card earlier. And at the beginning of his journey, he's very, Nook is very much the embodiment of the Fool, which is, as I mentioned, is card zero and represents the start of the hero's journey. But the next, this is essentially his kind of transformation at this point, through all the various different things he's gone on throughout his journey. And, I would say at this point, he's now become, the card which is number one within the major arcana, which is the Magician. So, and this ties in with all of these elemental aspects and the coming together of the four elements that I'd mentioned previously, as well as the tarot card of the Magician in its, you know, in the classical representation, is depicted with the four suits of the tarot. So he has the sword, which represents air, which is connected with thoughts and communication. He has the cup, which represents water, which is connected with the emotions. The wand, which represents fire, which is connected with, you know, passion and creativity. And then there's the pentacle, or the coin, representing earth, which is connected to work, home, material possessions. And some say, or some speculate at least, that the small bag that the Fool is carrying actually holds these four items. So this symbolizes these four elements being brought together and their alchemical properties being in balance with the within the individualism. I mean, the Magician card itself is, you know, it's rich with all of this symbolism. It has these red and white flowers together growing up from the same plant. And this is symbolic of the union between masculine and feminine, the integration of the opposites, the Red King and the White Queen in the alchemical wedding. And the Magician as well is, he is depicted with one, hand pointing to the sky and the other, to the ground, so I guess similar to the pose that John Travolta's striking in the Saturday Night Fever posters. But yeah, this gesture is symbolic of the hermetic principle of as above, so below, which is essentially the idea that what happens in the heavens is reflected on earth and vice versa. The idea as well of that the microcosm is the macrocosm, and that the outer world reflects the inner world, which is, you know, tied to this psychological journey of Nook, as well as his physical journey, and how these things are all interrelated, and how the four elements are brought together really at this point.
Yeah, so, and we just mentioned that, didn't we, about how the physical needs of Nook throughout his journey are symbolic of his spiritual needs, you know, with being frozen and soaked, and then he requires fire obviously to warm up. And on a spiritual, symbolic, spiritual level, it's that same idea that he needs to be resurrected by fire. You know, he needs to return by the power of fire. So yeah, that's the whole as above, so below thing, you know. And I wrote a song for Walkinsman for the first album called The Fire Bow, and the lyrics for that song are essentially about that. They're about how physical material phenomena are representative of spiritual ones. So there's the idea of the bow glistening gold now. So when we change from summer to autumn and the trees lose their leaves, you know, they become gold, or they change in a physical sense, but everything changes in a spiritual sense as well. So that's always kind of been quite central to the themes in my music, in Walkinsman, and my lyrics. But when you mentioned a minute ago that a bag that the Fool holds, is that, do you think that's the same symbol as I believe it's called, generally referred to as the Bag of Holding. And you have all of these ancient Egyptian and like Mesoamerican carvings where you have these characters, these entities holding bags, and the bag looks almost identical whether you go from, you know, the Middle East, North Africa, South America. There's these strange, mysterious bags that these that the figures depicted seem to be carrying. And I believe it's generally referred to as the Bag of Holding or something like that. Would you say that that's the same thing?
Well, you know, what's in Enki's bag, right? I mean, this is the question that keeps me up at night, right? I want to know what's in there. As like you say, this same kind of what seems to be a small bag is depicted, you know, in all of these various different carvings all across the world. But yeah, I mean, I've never heard that drawn together like that. But yeah, perhaps you're right. It's that is what the Bag of Holding has. It's the bringing together of these. It could be a symbolic of that, really. And that's maybe what people are pointing to when they see that the bag on the Fool card. And then the Magician is the card that follows that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think that's something for a bit more investigation.
Certainly.
Yeah, so Nook, he goes to the back of the cave and he kind of finds his way through, you know, and I tried to be as descriptive as I could because my favourite stories, you know, and this is one of the reasons I'm a huge Tolkien fan, is because he describes the world around the character so vividly. And I love that. Nothing frustrates me more than a novel where there are no descriptions of the surroundings of the characters, because I want to know. I want to be able to put myself in that place to feel. Places have always been very important to me. I've always like picked up on the energy of a place very quickly. So having the ability to do that when I'm reading a book as well is important to me. So I tried my best to do that. So I describe Nook's journey through the kind of slimy nooks of the back of this cave up into the cavern where, you know, he meets his destiny. And so he enters this enormous, vast cavern, this black cavern, which he cannot see. And the only thing he can see is a very, very faint glow in the distance. And he has no idea what's causing this glow or anything like that. And it just kind of, it picks up the edges of columns and things in this vast cavern, but he can barely see. Symbolically, the darkness of the cavern is, I'm going to skip ahead and, you know, he encounters a giant, you know, this gigantic character, this nemesis at the end, who is sleeping at the far end of the cavern. And the darkness of this giant is described as being black and slimy, and so is the cave. And that is symbolic of the lack of truth, you know, and this is that classic thing of truth is light and darkness is lies. You know, once you shine light upon the truth, it no longer is dark anymore. So it was a very childlike way of linking lies and you know, horrible, abhorrent things in the form of the cavern that this giant dwells in, and the giant itself with the light of truth and things like that. You know, nothing original there whatsoever. But Nook emerges into this, and he realizes that his destiny lies where this faint glow is across the cave. So he makes his way across this vast cavern, and eventually sees that there is a sleeping giant or ogre at one end or corner of the cave. And he sees that in the hand of this giant, it's clutching this kind of glowing talisman, this tiny artifact, which is giving off a glow. And he realizes that he, for whatever reason, he doesn't know exactly what it is or why, but he knows that he needs to win that back from this abhorrent entity. So events ensue. He at this point we hear the voices of the maidens, the weird sisters again, and it's actually these voices that wake the giant up. So rather than the footsteps of Nook himself, so again it's the idea that destiny is out of his hands. Destiny is causing a certain circumstance to come about. Regardless of what Nook does or doesn't do, something is going to happen because it's part of a bigger plan, a grander plan. And it's these other entities that are there with him that are not there physically, but they're there in spirit. And they are causing things to play out in a certain way. And that's what these voices represent. So the giant wakes up and a fight ensues between Nook and the giant. The giant stumbles, and then Nook sees an opportunity. I think he takes 9 steps, then plunges his sword or dagger that the dwarves gave him into the temple in the side of the head of this entity. And yeah, there's a double meaning there: temple in the side of the head and temple. It's a kind of double entendre that I've always been fascinated by, the idea that we have a temple in the head and that we worship within a temple. And, you know, I'm far from the first person to make that connection. That goes back to time immemorial. But in this instance, it's the idea that by driving this sword into this this temple of lies, he is slaying not just the ogre itself, but everything that it represents. So yeah, at that point, yeah, I don't know if you've got anything to mention on all of that, Adam.
Sure. Well, to touch on the cave, I mean, the caves is symbolically often associated with ideas of death and rebirth and resurrection. And there's this great quote. I used to think it was Jung, but it's actually Joseph Campbell who said this. And obviously Jung had a huge influence on Campbell, but it's the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. So this is very much about the, you know, implying that the path you are afraid to take will ultimately lead to self-actualization and individuation, and will thrust you towards your destiny. And yeah, I mean, when I got to this chapter, which is Sprig to Spear, I mean, Sprig to Spear is probably my favorite track on Fire in the White Stone. So I was really interested to see what the events were going to be. I mean, it opens with these, these heroic sounding horns, and these combined with these choral vocals. It kind of makes me really nostalgic. It kind of makes me think of some 80s sword and sorcery fantasy adventures. Almost as good as the Conan the Barbarian soundtrack, and the lyrics as well. Rich with all of these Odinic themes. What seemed strange at the time when I heard the track in isolation, but this and I wasn't aware of the connections with Odin here, but this self-identification with the spear, and as far as I understand, with Odin's spear, when it is thrown, it always hits its target.
Yes, I believe that is the case. Yeah.
Yeah. So Nook at this point in the story becomes very much aware that he's, you know, accepting his destiny or fate, you know, and in the song he's being flung like a spear. You know, he's embracing his weird or his destiny, but it also comes with this bittersweet acceptance of one's fate at the same time.
Yeah, and I'd just like to, I mean, again, it feels a little bit self-indulgent, but I feel at this point that I maybe should have referenced some of the lyrics a bit more, because they do act as a counterpart to the short story itself. And anyone who enjoys the short story, I would, even if you don't like my music, I would recommend reading the lyrics. And I do include the lyrics as an appendix in the back of the book, because there are certain things which are expressed in the lyrics which aren't expressed in the story, and vice versa. But the lyrics to Spruik to Spear, I am particularly proud of, and I'd just like to read them quickly. This kind of starts, these lyrics begin when Nook is at the back of the cave with the dwarves, and he finally sees himself, the shadow that is being cast by the fire against the back of the rock. And this is where the lyrics kind of pick up. There's a shadow etched in stone of a likeness to my own, where I fearsome, born of war, where I feasting at the High One's hall. There's a rising tide in me, pulling forth a swollen sea. Should I storm death's hefty door, as a wave that hammers on the shore? I see the hanging tree that tethers me as I fare forth. With a burning blade in hand and a breed now come to brand, there a blaze I will to grow, where a shadow feeds upon the glow. As a spear I am thread through the woven darkness, gift of Gar. As a spear I am thread through the woven darkness, seek and sow. And we spoke about, you know, I mentioned about that last section with Nook being the spear wielded by higher forces. There's also, you know, the line where there's a shadow etched in stone of a likeness to my own, where I fearsome, born of war. So it's like he's seeing a representation of himself as if he were a powerful warrior, as if he were worthy of feasting at the High One's hall, you know, Valhalla. But then he's starting to realize that he is embodying that shadow that he sees, and he sees, you know, I see the hanging tree that tethers me as I fare forth. And that's kind of another double entendre. You know, we have the tree, the gallows, where men are hung upon, but also the tree of Yggdrasil, which Woden hangs upon for 9 days and nights to pick up the runes. So it's the idea that he is finally discovering the truth for himself, whilst also facing his own mortality. So I just thought it was worth mentioning those lyrics there. And, you know, it is a song that I am also particularly proud of as well. So I'm glad you enjoy that one as well, Adam.
Yeah, pretty much got that one on repeat. It's great. It's very inspiring. Certainly kind of makes the walk to work a bit more interesting. The ogre here in this chapter, I mean, your description of the ogre is just absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's just so, and especially with your reading of it as well in the audiobook. I mean, it's it's depicted as absolutely disgusting, this slimy black green rotting flesh. And it's, you know, there's a point as well where Nook picks up on the mind of the ogre, similar to how he has this kind of somewhat psychic connection with the swans. He's able to kind of perceive the mind of the swans in the same way he's able to perceive the mind of the ogre. And it just has it has nothing positive in it in whatsoever. The ogre itself almost seems to be this manifestation of unrestrained greed, envy, you know, in that it stole wealth from the creative, not to not to possess it, but to dispossess others of it.
This is and there was a little bit of a nod there to one of my favorite poems by Ezra Pound, With Usura, the poem hits me hard every time. It's about the crimes of usury, not about the literal stealing of wealth, but about the effects that has, you know. And for those who aren't aware, usury is the idea of gaining interest on money through no labor. So basically making money from money without engaging in any kind of labor to gain that money. And obviously modern banking practices are riddled with usury, and it's something that I've always been proudly against. And With Usura by Ezra Pound, in that poem he describes, he really brings to life the damage that does to the craftsman, to beauty to love, to the joy of young lovers, things like this. And it's true, you know, when you really start to think about these usurious banking crimes which are committed against us and have been for centuries, and you really start to extrapolate out the effect that that has on all of us, not just in our material well-being, but in our ability to even create art and things like that. So that's what I was trying to get at there with that line. And yeah, I am particularly proud of that. It's the stealing wealth from others, not to possess it himself, but to dispossess others of it. It's just that this like hideous being who just wants misery for the world, who wants to snuff the light out of the world, to destroy everything beautiful about it, and seeking any means of doing that. And Nook says that when facing the lies that are embodied within this ogre, by facing the lies in the ogre, he then knows the truth. So it's that exchange of, and that line that you just mentioned, Adam, the Joseph Campbell quote, I forget about the, you know, facing your darkest cave is the one that you need to face. That's where you will find the truth. And it's that same idea here, is that, you know, only by facing the most abysmal of lies and horrors can you discover the truth.
Yeah, very much so. And I think your depiction of the ogre was absolutely perfect for that. As for Ezra Pound, I've only recently started to get into his work, so I'll have to check out that poem that you mentioned.
I'm not as familiar with his wider canon of works as I should be, and as I intend to be. But With Usurer is the one that I know best, and it's one of my favorite poems.
Yeah, so I mean, the ogre here is, as I mentioned, is this very kind of like manifestation of just greed and envy and usury. And I mean, this is quite a common mythological trope. Usually, this is associated with the dragon. Now, we've had a bit of back and forth, in the private chat surrounding the true intention of the dragon, whether it's a force of good or ill. Really, I think it kind of, has this kind of dual nature. But in Brian Bates's book, the Real Middle Earth, the dragon is symbolic of the darker side of wealth, which is why you often get these dragons sat on top of piles of jewels and gold. And they represent the inevitable life cycle of civilizations, which I imagine is when wealth and power centralizes and creates a tyranny. Now, the ogre is also sat on top of a, you know, there's a pile of treasure, of which one of the treasure is the chalice as well.
Yeah. So Nook realizes after, you know, he picks up this artifact, this trinket, as he, I think I describe it, when it's in the hand of the ogre, he picks this up after slaying the giant and discovers that it is a white stone chalice. So this is the white stone. This is the chalice, the grail, so to speak. And again, I'm not pretending that there's anything particularly original about this, except for the fact that I had connected the Anglo-Frisian Kalch rune being the chalice to the fact that it is called Kalch or chalk, so that it is a white stone, so that it is both the chalice and the white stone in one thing, which, as far as I know, is a unique or novel idea of my own. So that's what the white stone is in this story. It is the white stone chalice, and it had been upside down in the palm of the hand of this giant, and it had been glowing because it has this otherworldly energy. It has this potency to it, just the stone itself. So at this point in the story, Nook turns the stone chalice the right way up, and he knows, he then kind of begins to understand that this is the answer to everything. This is the key to everything. He returns to the cave where the dwarves are. He plunges the chalice into the fire that's in the cave where, you know, he first encounters the dwarves. And this whole kind of burst of greenish light appears. And we talked in part one, Adam and I, about my being drawn to green light, the kind of mystical nature of green light, how it always represents something mystical and spiritual to me. So that's why I depicted this light as being kind of a greenish. There's an otherworldliness to green light. You know, if you're ever in like a an evergreen forest under the power of moonlight, and the way that it lights up moss, that kind of otherworldly green that you get, to me that's an extremely mystical spiritual experience, and it's something which I can't help but kind of bring forth when I describe things like this, like in this story. So this the combination of the chalice with the fire, that is the key to everything, and that is the restoration of the civilization that Nook comes from. It restores everything that the civilization has been lacking. And from that point... I am the spark and mine is fire. In the white stone I bend. Wielding a sword to slay the then returns back through the story. He passes the maidens. The world kind of rushes by him because it's this way of describing how just merely holding, being in the presence of this chalice kind of changes the way that we interact with the physical world. You know, it sheds light upon everything. It enhances everything. And he travels back, he passes the maidens, he passes the swans of Gar's Edge, who now have their beaks, both of them have their beaks freed. He returns to Modersley and he is welcomed there by the townsfolk, by his wife Marin, who, as we talked about briefly in part one, Marin then dances over to him, you know, the thing that he'd been wishing for her to express herself in that way all along. And she has now rediscovered that ability to kind of engage in the simple joys of life, the expression of dancing, of celebrating one's humanity in that way. So I've kind of skipped right to the end of the story there, and that is the conclusion of it. But there's plenty to talk about there. And Adam, I don't know if you had any kind of thoughts or questions about any of the events that I've just mentioned.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot there. So first of all, I was interested in the slaying of the ogre, and that Nook slays the ogre by stabbing it in the left temple. Mm-hmm. Was there any? I know you mentioned this kind of illusion between temple, as in between the temple, you know, of the head, and also a place of worship. But was there any particular conscious choice between the selection of it being the left temple specifically?
I suppose it was this. You know, we have the concept of the left brain and the right brain. If the left side of your body is controlled by the right side of your brain, and vice versa. So people who are left-handed tend to have a slightly dominant right brain. People who are right-handed tend to have a slightly dominant left brain. People who are left brain tend to be very methodical, very calculating, very kind of tied to the order of the material world, tend to have, an imbalance towards the mundane, I guess, to practical tasks, to the practical nature of existence, whereas those who are right-brained and left-handed or left-footed tend to be a little bit more ditzy, and I say that in the most loving way possible. My wife is left-handed, and her spiritual intuition is far greater than mine. You know, her ability to pick up on spirits and you know, the atmosphere of people and places. You know, when people talk about auras and things like that, people who tend to claim that they can pick up on the auras of other people often tend to be right brain people. So Nook slaying the giant by plunging the sword into the left temple was the idea of kind of rebalancing, the idea that, you know, the human world had become too balanced overall towards the left brain, you know, the right handedness, the right side of the body, the mundane, the practical, away from the more spiritual side of things, which is the right brain. So that's what I was kind of getting at with there, but it's a very subtle hint. And it's an example of one of the hundreds of tiny little symbols, which I kind of hid in the story, which I don't think many people will have picked up on.
Yeah, that was exactly what I thought you might have been indicating by selecting the left temple there. You know, as you mentioned, with the left hemisphere of the brain, you know, loosely, I guess more symbolically, it's a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's associated with the intellect, linear processes, scientific thinking.
Yeah.
Very much the way in which the educational system churns out people, most certainly within the West.
Yes.
And as you mentioned as well, with your wife being just naturally more right-brained, that does tend to be the case. That's the what's referred to as the lunar aspect of the mind, as opposed to the solar aspect in the right hemisphere. So that's the feminine principle. Now, chronic domination of either of these hemispheres can just cause all sorts of problems. And I would say that there's certainly been a weaponization of this kind of chronic domination of either the left or the right hemisphere. And this is what kind of causes so many kind of like conflicts, why people kind of tend to talk past one another, that you can essentially weaponize this imbalance through kind of almost worldview warfare through this kind of like chronic imbalance of the hemispheres. So I thought that was particularly of note, that he slays the ogre or the giant by plunging the blade into the left temple specifically there.
Yeah, and of course we do, balance is important. You know, I'm not trying to suggest that we can do away with the left side of the brain. Not at all. It was just a perhaps maybe slightly clumsy way of symbolizing the idea that we need to correct the balance, because I do believe that we are in the modern Western scientific secular world, we are weighted towards the left side of the brain to a harmful degree. So it's just the idea of correcting that balance somewhat.
Yeah, very much so. And as I mentioned, there's all of this throughout the story, there's these kind of oppositional forces, whether that's the kind of elemental kind of opposition that we've gone through. But yeah, as I mentioned, that the left hemisphere is symbolically is the masculine solar aspect. And this is represented with the symbol of the blade. So it feels significant that Nook's blade ends up meeting with its symbolic counterpart at this point,
and cancelling each other out. Yeah,
exactly. And also the wider connection of that, as well, is that because, as we mentioned, this green glow, and how I mentioned how the fool is one who's following his heart, and by Nook following his heart throughout every part of the quest, it has led him to the chalice, which is the feminine symbol, and this is the lunar aspect and represents the right side of the brain. So it's almost like these two aspects have kind of met with one another, you know, at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he, you know, he, as I say, travels back to Modersley, and as he goes, the gods, whites and ancestors flock to him. You know, it's, you know, we often talk about, you know, those of us who are pagans particularly, we often, well, some people who aren't pagans will often accuse us of saying, you know, the gods have abandoned you, or the gods don't exist and things like this. But whereas as pagans, we would say, no, we abandoned the gods, we left them. And this is kind of symbolized in this story in the sense that Nook's life feels very godless to begin with. You know, there is no talk of any religion or spiritual tradition really among the people of Modersley or the Westwolds more widely. You know, they are essentially a materialist people by this point. They have abandoned the gods and ancestors. Nook, by engaging on this hero's journey, recovers the thing which then enables, which then invites the gods, ancestors and whites back into the lives of him and the other people of the lands. You know, they flock towards the light of the white stone. And it's interesting, one of the podcasts I've done, you know, in recent months, you know, long after writing this story, with Anders Nilsson, who wrote a good little book called The Way of Wotan. And one of the things that he mentioned in the podcast, and I've referred to this again and again because I think it was a very profound statement, he said that we need to both symbolically and physically become a beacon of light so that the gods can see us. That's one of the purposes of ritual, is to turn ourselves into a beacon of light so that they can see us. And we do this, you know, spiritual men will throughout history have always generally worn white, or certainly commonly have worn white during ritual. We light fires during ritual. And Anders talked about symbolically making ourselves a beacon of light by performing noble acts. By performing honourable acts, we therefore turn ourselves into a beacon of light. And by doing so, the gods then are attracted to us. They can then see us. They can recognise us. We become a beacon that they can hone in on. And it's the same in this story. And I guess I didn't intend it with such intent when I wrote Fire and the White Stone, but yes, it's that idea that the brightness of the white stone and of Nook's actions then attracts all of divinity to him, finally, and to his folk more widely.
Yeah, and something I didn't mention as well is the grail and a white stone, being a white stone, is actually something that's in Wolfram von Eschenbach's Grail mythos. It's equated with a white stone in that instance. But yeah, I loved, and also I kind of unearthed this kind of connection between the kind of Odinic qualities of Wolfram von Eschenbach's name, which has its whole kind of, I did an esoteric analysis on the Gnostic Intel channel surrounding that. So it's kind of interesting how these two, the Arthurian legends, the Grail mythos, and paganism and aspects of Gnosticism as well, all kind of like fused together around this mythos of the Grail. And it's great that this was the, you know, what brought us together essentially and had this discussion about your book.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the Grail mythos is almost the overlap. You know, what do you call those charts where you have, I forget the name, we have three
circles. Venn diagram.
Venn diagram, that's it. It's almost like the Grail mythos is almost the center point of a Venn diagram between, you know, Indo-European paganism and Gnosticism and, you know, more kind of, I don't know what you would call it, I guess you'd call it more contemporary Arthurian lore. It seems to be the point of unison for all of those things. And that is definitely something that I wanted, that I intended to do with Fire and the White Stone, was to shine a light upon those fundamental similarities, particularly between heathenry and the Grail mythos. Not as much Gnosticism, because I wasn't, even though I've had a fairly long-standing interest in Gnosticism, and particularly the work of John Lash, and that's one of the things that Adam and I have kind of bonded over, is our mutual appreciation of John Lash's work. And John, of course, was a guest in episode 8 of the Fergan podcast, if anyone is interested in listening back to that. But Adam, did you want to talk a little bit about the Gnostic links of the symbolism here, or...
It's quite elaborate and complicated. And I'm kind of working through the mysteries of the Grail on the Gnostic Intel channel to kind of slowly kind of work through that particular process.
Okay. Let's leave that for now. Sure. I think needless to say that there are some definite significances there between fundamental Gnostic tradition and heathenry and the Grail mythos. There is definitely that shared area within the Venn diagram.
Yes, most certainly.
And yeah, I'm sure, like, those of you who are listening to this, you know, I really do encourage you to at least follow Adam's Gnostic Intel channel. I've said it before, it's one of, if not my favorite Telegram channel. And I think that the stuff he comes up with on there is just brilliant. Every single post I get something important from. So if he's going to be expounding upon that over coming months on that channel, then that's definitely something to follow. But that's pretty much the story covered there. I don't think that there's anything that I've, just looking at my notes, I don't think that there's anything I've missed out. Maybe other than to say that the overall final purpose of the discovery of the stone, the white stone chalice, is that it ushers in a new golden age. You know, and this ties into the, you know, various traditions where we have different ages. You know, in the Vedic tradition, we're currently in Kali Yuga, the worst, darkest, most darkest of ages, and that it will be followed by a returning golden age at some point, and that this is the catalyst in my story for the return of that golden age. So yeah, any kind of final thoughts, anything that we've missed out, Adam, that you want to pick up on?
Oh, sure. So, I mean, I was wondering here if the chalice is the second sun that Farmer Borrell refers to, or the new sun, essentially, you know, starting this new golden age.
I hadn't really thought of that, but I suppose I do describe the entirety of the land and even the underside of the clouds in the sky being brightly illuminated by the white stone. So in that sense, it does take over the purpose of the sun. And even though I didn't write explicitly of it taking the place of the existing sun, I suppose it could be seen in that way, particularly as the second sun is meant to represent the spiritual health and rejuvenation of everything. So that is exactly what the white stone chalice does when activated at the end. It rejuvenates everything spiritually. So, yeah, maybe I missed a trick there. Maybe I could have written a couple of extra pages about how the white stone chalice then becomes the new sun of the era, but maybe it's best to have left that up to the reader's imagination.
Oh no, I thought that you kind of subtly alluded to that. I thought that's why you had the story about the second son from Farmer Borrell to begin with.
No, and not really. No, that was just I don't know, just trying to kind of fill out the world that I was trying to create, just trying to, you know, it was an act of world building, really. And mm-hmm. as I mentioned in part one of this discussion, it was really just a way to highlight the fact that the townspeople did have these very vague memories of more spiritual ideas, but that they no longer believed in them, and that they had now embraced, you know, pure science and materialism in favor of these old wives' tales. It wasn't really meant to represent anything beyond that. And no, I didn't intentionally try to tie the second son into the chalice itself.
Sure. There's a connection as well between the Grail and, as I mentioned, ancient fertility rites, even dating back to the Bronze Age. So Jessie L. Weston made this connection in her book From Ritual to Romance, where she essentially posits the idea that the Grail mythos itself is essentially the encoding of ancient fertility rites, and it very much connects with the idea that's expressed in the John Borman film Excalibur, which with the idea of the king and the land being one, essentially. And it was through these kind of fertility rites that they kind of fused and created that connection. So it's very interesting that within Far in the Whitestone, as he kind of gets the Grail and then returns back to Modisley, that the you know, spring is returning, that the life is restoring to the land. It reminded me of that, that the sequence where they're riding out and all in Excalibur and all of the flowers are opening. Also the beaks of the swans have now melted and their plumage is in pure white, and that life is restored to the land. And another thing as well is that as he's returning to Modisley, you have this, it was almost like a book ending. With the opening of chapter two, Nook he sees the fireflies dancing around his torch as he leaves the town, and he wishes that his wife would dance freely. And that's exactly what happens at the end. As he returns to Modisley, he sees Maron, who dances towards him, and the White Stone.
Yeah. I mean, that was a deliberate bookending, really. It was. I guess it's kind of a symbolic of the fact that there is a restoration on a personal level for Nook, as well as on a societal level. So the land has been bathed in light and restored, and, you know, in the way that you just described, Adam, but also his own personal relationships have been restored as a result as well. And that's kind of goes with the idea that by embracing our part in the divine plan, even though at times it can be quite uncomfortable and it can feel like we're sacrificing certain things, ultimately, it's going to be better for us on a personal level, not just, you know, wider society, you know, as we have a concern for our folk more generally and the well-being of humanity. But, you know, there is there's a macro and a micro of that. You know, things improve on the macro and they also improve in our lives as well. And, you know, even though I've lost a lot of friends over the years, not just over the last 3 years with the whole COVID psyop, but prior to that as well, I've left people behind who just I didn't feel were kind of part of my journey moving ahead and things that I felt no ill will towards them. You know, we do kind of shed these things as we move ahead. But overall, I can definitely say that embracing my calling to speak up publicly, you know, as implored to do so by the swans, has absolutely enriched my life. It's made me more content. It's brought a lot more meaning to my life. Not material wealth, but certainly spiritual and psychological health have been improved because of embracing that, and my relationship, you know, with my wife and with other people who are particularly important to me has improved. So Maron dancing towards Nook is symbolic of that. The fact that by embracing what you are meant to do in life rather than fighting against it, things will improve on a macro level and on a personal level.
Wow. Yes. Not only you have kind of, benefited from that on a kind of spiritual level, but also, you know, I guess anyone listening to this now, you know, have enjoyed your music and this wonderful book that you put together as well, from that dream and embracing destiny, embracing your fate, loving your fate, and following your weird in that sense. Now, I had somewhat of an interesting experience after we recorded the first episode.
So, oh, yes, I want to hear about this. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm still kind of in shock from it, to be honest. So if you hold that final line of the story strongly in your mind, of Maron slowly dancing gracefully towards Nook. So on the day after we recorded the first part of the podcast, I was relaxing at home and decided to you know, relax and listen to some music. So I actually ended up putting Fire in the Whitestone on. But I actually played Songs from the Mere, which is the B-side of the second record. And, you know, just as the ferryman is the opening track, and my mind is immediately, you know, I'm taken to the Sacred Grove, which is, you know, where your music tends to transport me. And I, you know, begin kind of like pondering, you know, my appearance on the podcast and the work that I'd kind of put into the various points of the analysis, and also how my story of, you know, me coming on the podcast and speaking to you. I mean, it might not seem like a big deal for those who are listening, but it's very much outside of my comfort zone. And Dan, like last instance in the story, gave me this not too subtle nudge, plunging me into the deep. So
honestly, Adam, I can't think of a better person to have had this conversation with. So no, I'm grateful to you.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored that you would choose me. So I'll get back to my story. I'm thinking about, you know, all of these improbable, impossible events, you know, that when you kind of look back at your kind of life, you kind of, I don't know, you wonder how you kind of ended up, you know, where you are. And, you know, there's been all of these kind of subtle kind of, not too subtle kind of nudges, you know, pushing me in this particular direction. And, you know, I when I read your book, I, you know, right from the opening where I, you know, I you were talking about furrows, the ball, and six long nights and a moon, and they were just so rich with all of this symbolism, and it just set my mind racing really at that point. So yeah, I was delighted when you asked me to come and speak about it. So I'd been thinking about your recent conversation with Mark
Mark
on the law, which is the last episode of the Fergan podcast at the point where we're recording this, and you discuss this idea of seeking confirmation from the gods after a ritual or a sacrifice that has been made in their honor, and I'm thinking about this idea, and that the ferryman is just it's just ending now. Like, it has this kind of ambient synths at the end that kind of like slowly kind of like fade out. And it comes into my mind at this very moment that I should seek confirmation from the gods, you know, for, you know, putting my efforts into the podcast and, you know, throwing myself into the deep and, you know, appearing on the podcast and chatting with you. Now, recall that final line in Fire in the White Stone. And now, just at the
let me just read that line just so we've got it precise. Yes. There at the end. Yeah. So the last line is, Nook's back and forth sweeping gaze caught itself upon one face among many, the homeliness of Marin, who, gently pushing her way through her through the front row, danced gracefully towards Nook and the white stone.
Well, there we go. Yeah. So at that exact moment that in my mind I had decided to seek confirmation from the gods, there was the opening piano chord of Lady of the Deep, which is the second song on Songs from the Mere. Yeah. And at that exact moment, the door to the front room opens, and you've got this intricate guitar melody. And then, without saying a word or even acknowledging me whatsoever, my wife enters the room and starts doing this really beautiful, elaborate, medieval dance to Lady of the Deep. Now, she's not read your book. She has no real interest in that I'm chatting with you on this podcast.
Yeah.
And she's there, and she's dancing for like 2 or 3 minutes. And I'm just staring. Also, my wife doesn't spontaneously break out doing medieval dances around the house either, so this is it's quite an unusual activity. So I'm just staring at her in, you know, in complete amazement. No, I've seen her dance to music before, but never to music like this. And I've, just like Marin in the story, never seen her dance so freely with such grace as well. And so at this point she hasn't, she hasn't said a word. I haven't spoken either. I'm just speechless at this point. And she slowly dances towards me. And I stand up and she embraces me. Then she reaches back behind me. And one of the things we have on our shelves is these various different pewter chalices. And she takes the chalice and she holds it in her hand. And then she offers it to me. So at this point, I decide I need to get some further clarification. I'm just, you know, I have to say I'm quite kind of shocked by this event. So I decide to consult the tarot, because that's what I tend to do. That's my kind of system of divination. I know that you have the runes to draw upon. At tarot is somewhat tied to my kind of ancestral tradition, and I've always had a deep love of the tarot.
But it's so it's the same principle. So
yes,
yeah.
I mean, you can conduct divination for a whole range of different methods. I mean, this is why people read tea leaves or animal entrails, or, you know, look at the clouds. There's even modern divination techniques. There's something called shufflemancy, which is where you put all of your music into a playlist, and then you just press shuffle, and it's what track kind of comes out is the track that is essentially divining in that sense. I don't think I would use modern technology as part of divination, though. I think I would steer clear of that if possible. So yeah, I mean, I won't go into the full details of the tarot reading, but the first card that I draw immediately after this experience is the Ten of Cups. I mean, this is a really beautiful, hopeful, and optimistic card. It has a couple with a small child stood beneath a rainbow. And this card has this huge amount of personal significance to me, as it was the card that I drew on the day that I met my wife. Before I met her, there was a sudden rainstorm, and I went into my room and decided to draw a tarot card for the day, and it was the Ten of Cups. And it really confused me at that time, as I don't think it was really a card that ever really came up in my various different readings that I've done over the years. And I put the card down, and just at that moment, a beam of light came through the crack in the curtains and shone directly onto the card. As you recall, the card has this a beautiful rainbow on the card. So I pick up the card and walk over to the balcony, and right outside, just at that exact moment, there's a rainbow, just like the one on the card. And I looked at it, and I went to get my my stupid modern mind, you know, said, "Oh, just go and get your phone. This will be great for Instagram or whatever rubbish I was using at the time." But just at that moment, it was almost like the universe, the earth itself, the gods, whoever was showing me this sign. It said, "He's seen the sign. That's enough, right?" And the rainbow, it almost immediately disappeared at the point in which I looked at it. So I carried on with my reading, and I decided to draw 9 cards, and then I get to card number 8, and I hold in my mind very, very clearly, where is this information coming from? And of course, I draw the World card. Now, for me, you know, the world being pointed to as the source of the message is particularly pertinent to me. You know, as within Gnosticism, the central deity is literally the earth itself, the planetary intelligence, the Aeon Sophia. So, and then I draw my final 9th card, which I always place this one above all of the others, as I see it as kind of informing the kind of, it's essentially the defining the structure and shaping and molding the whole reading. I was also holding in my head the question of when should we record the second half of the podcast. So for this, I drew the 3 of Cups, And the Three of Cups has three maidens entwined in some kind of dance, and each one of them is holding a chalice aloft. So it's very much connected in with the story. These would be the maidens of Rhymeland, or the Weird Sisters. And being placed on top of the whole reading, they're creating that web of weird of all of those things, and they're bringing all of that together. And I very much kind of, everything just fell into place at that exact moment. And right as that was all coming together in my mind, there's a point where From Sprig to Spear was playing, and just as it clicked in my mind, the line "I see" came in your song, and it all became complete, really clear to me at that point. And of course, the Three of Cups, you know, pointing to when to record part two. Well, it just so happens that, you know, today is the 30th, and our schedules were such that we had to start recording at 3 o'clock. And of course, this is episode 33. So there you go.
I can see why you were speechless. That is amazing. Yeah, Adam chose to save this story for telling me live in the conversation. Well, not live, but in the recording conversation. So it's the first time I've heard it. And yeah, that's profound. Though it must be said, I mean, I think the aspect of your wife dancing over to you, that is a hell of a coincidence. And for people like us who don't believe in coincidence, it's therefore a hell of a serendipitous or meaningful event. The other things that you identified, I mean, you need to have what's called symbol literacy, and that's what you have. I mean, a lot of people could have drawn tarot cards or seen the rainbow or, you know, things like that and not made any connection whatsoever. But your literacy enables you to do that. I mean, that's not to take away from, I mean, it is absolutely a confirmation. I agree with you. And an amazing way to kind of end the experience, really. But it's because of your ability to read those symbols. And this is, I mean, this is the core of it all, really. This is the core of heathen, pagan, occult practice, is having the ability is to recognize that the world around us is full of markers and symbols and signs and divine interventions. And the only variable factor is in our ability to recognize those symbols. And whether that be in the story that Adam and I have discussed over these last two episodes, or in the event, the experiences that Adam had after recording the first part of it, having the ability to recognize those symbols and their significance is that's the key, really, to having a proper occult esoteric understanding. Magic is not really having the ability to, it is having the ability to affect change around you, but not in a kind of supernatural way. Magic really is having the ability to read the signs around you, to work with them in such a way that benefits not just yourself, but humanity on a wider scale. What do you think about that, Adam?
Yeah, very much so. And I've always been an advocate of what you were saying with Mark regarding confirmation from the gods. This is something that I've almost kind of instinctively done. So it was great to get kind of acknowledgement from the law there that this was actually the correct thing to do, and that's something that we should be pursuing. As I very much see, you know, we don't have an off planet father god, so to speak, you know, off in some other dimension, or way outside of the experiential realm. We are in divinity itself. We are actually, we can experience these things. We don't have to, you know, rely on a corrupt priest class of the temple, right? We can experience these things directly. It's just attuning ourselves to being receptive to these signs and these symbols, and also, you know, making these, doing things that will honor the gods as well, you know, in order to kind of receive that kind of confirmation back.
Yeah, it's a real preoccupation of mine lately has been this idea that, and it's been a flaw in my own heathen practice as well. we assume as heathens, as pagans, that, you know, if we perform the rituals in the most authentic way possible, then that is pagan practice. That is, you know, and any bloat or symbol that I've been part of, for the most part, in most instances, it simply consists of a group of people stood reciting certain words in honor of particular gods on particular days of the year. Wonderful. You know, that is correct if done with sincerity and passion. But almost never have I seen anyone then seek feedback to know whether the gods have even accepted that gift, that practice of that worship, that bloat, that sacrifice. I'm realizing more and more now recently, and Adam's story very much, you know, ties into this, and my conversation with Mark Perrier in episode number 31 of the Fergan podcast, Observing the Law, very much ties into this idea that an essential part of ritual practice is divination of some sort, or at least opening oneself up to signs and symbols, giving yourself that time to then be aware of what is being spoken back to you after you have offered something to the gods. So whether you do a rune casting, or maybe your type of occult practice involves tarot, as with Adam's, or, you know, whether you are simply looking out for signs, maybe seeing certain birds or animals, you know, as we've discussed in this episode, birds are a particularly important natural sign of divinity. Whether you're looking out for those things, or, you know, there are various ways, meditation you could engage in after performing ritual. You could even, if you are so compelled, go down the route of consuming some kind of entheogen, psychedelic, you know, mushroom or some other substance to try and break down that barrier between the material realm of perception and the more kind of less material realm of perception. You could see whether that gives you some kind of response from divinity. You know, there are various ways, and it's extremely important, and I would say under appreciated by most practicing pagans, that this is something we need to be doing. And what Adam's just described is a perfect example of being open to the symbols which are given to us as a response for the act that we have engaged in, the ritual or spiritual act that we have engaged in. That's something that I'm trying to do more and more, you know. And the reason that runes work, I can't remember which book it is that I read recently, but it was a perfect explanation of why runic or tarot divination works. And it's something like, you know, when you pull certain runes out of a bag in an instance, in that moment, no other possible runes could be pulled out. Those runes are meant to come out at that moment in time. Nothing can change what is meant to be pulled out of that bag at that moment. Nothing else will come out. Only those runes will come out. And it's a language. The runes are a language between us and divinity. The gods can't literally speak to us with human voices. They can't write a letter to us. But what they can do is to, through the weave of weird, they can ensure that certain signs are presented to us at the correct moment. And then it is up to us to be able to read those signs. That's how divination works. And in my experience, it always works. If you know how to read the runes, if you know how to read the tarot, if you know how to read the symbology of a story like Fire in the White Stone or Parsifal or any of the other related Arthurian books, or any of the sagas or stories in the Eddas, if you know how to read those things and understand the symbology of them, then it can enrich your life greatly, enormously. And to me, that's how I would describe true magic, is being able to work with nature, to be able to read the signs of nature and your experiences and to work with them so that they enforce prosperity and happiness in your life and for your community, rather than working against those things.
Yeah, that was a fantastic explanation as to how divination works. And like you with the runes, you know, that they just work every time, right? It's I'm very much the same with tarot. I'll have people ask me, "Oh, you believe in tarot?" And I'm like, "No, I don't believe in it. In fact, I'm highly skeptical. I'm someone who's highly skeptical of pretty much everything, really. And even my kind of mystical practices, I approach with a certain degree of skepticism too. But the tarot just about, it seems to just work every single time. Even at the point where, you know, such as withdrawing that, the Ten of Cups and, with the happy couple with a child, stood, looking out to a rainbow. At that point in my life, that had no correlation to anything that was occurring in my life whatsoever. And then picking up that card and seeing that the rainbow out there in the external world reflected from the card that I just read, and that being the day that I met my wife, is you know, it just works every time. And I guess it's kind of, you know, the opening yourself up to the mystical, opening yourself up to those experiences, and then following the signs wherever they may lead you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And no, I've got nothing more to say on this. And I'm sure, I mean, there are various things that we could have gone into much greater depth. And I do actually one day intend to do that. You know, maybe if Adam has the time and the will, then maybe he can assist me with that in some way, you know, either as an advisor or something like that, because I do very much admire Adam's ability to recognize and to draw links between certain symbols and things. You know, he's and that's why I say that I don't think that there was anyone better to discuss my short story Fire on the White Stone with me than Adam. And you know, as those of you who've listened to all of this will have heard, you know, he drew connections which I hadn't drawn nor had intended to be in the story in the first place. So, Adam, I'm enormously grateful for you for taking the time to, you know, just to read the story and to make some notes and then make the time to talk to me about it. I really hope that people have enjoyed these two episodes. I really have. I've really, really enjoyed discussing these concepts.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. I mean, it's an honor that you even thought of me to bring on the show for this. I've had a fantastic time diving deep into your first novel. It's been a fantastic conversation, and hopefully the first of many.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, I hope one day to find the time, but I kind of feel like I crammed so much into this one. I almost wonder what I would put into another one, but
it's incredibly rich, that's for sure. There is a lot in there. I mean, we could have gone, you know, hours and hours on this. There's so much material, and the more that I looked at it, the more I was finding in there. And it's an incredibly rich book of esoteric symbolism, and it seems to operate almost like a fractal pattern of sorts. You know, there's just so much there which has been channeled through you with this, both with the music and also the accompanying novel. So incredible work with that, I would say.
Well, thank you very much, Adam. I appreciate that. And yes, thank you everyone for listening, as always, to the Fergan podcast. And more information at fergan.com, fyrgen.com. I hope that no one has listened to all of this without having read the story, but if you have and you still feel compelled to read the story, then you can purchase a copy either directly from me at fergan.com, or you can go to lulu.com and search Fire in the White Stone and you'll see it there, or even Amazon. Amazon has both a printed and Kindle ebook version of the story, so it's quite easily available now. I do hope that people get something out of it. It's not a long story to read. It takes an hour and a half. It's suitable for people of all ages, really, I like to think. I hope that young people are picking it up as well. I think anyone from probably the age of 10 onwards could probably enjoy the story and read it no problem. So thank you all for listening, and I hope this hasn't come across as too self-indulgent. You know, I did try to explain at the beginning of the first part why I wanted to do this. And despite the fact that it did feel a little bit self-indulgent, but it's because there's so much symbolism in this, which isn't mine. You know, some of it is stuff that I came up with, connections I made, but a lot of it isn't particularly original, but it's all put together here in the form of a story. So it's kind of relevant to all people, particularly people of Indo-European ancestry. You know, we'll find it very familiar, and hopefully it kind of contributes in some small way to I don't know, the wider rejuvenation of our folk and of humanity as a whole. So yeah, thank you again, Adam. Really appreciate speaking with you, and thank you to everyone who listened. Those who are patrons or who follow the Telegram channel will be aware that this is the final Fergan podcast episode for the foreseeable future, certainly for some months to come. I made the announcement on those channels recently, and I've advised all patrons to cancel their subscribership with immediate effect. So if that includes you, firstly, thank you from the bottom of my heart for your support. Please do cancel your subscribership. I do intend for the Fergan podcast to return, perhaps towards the end of the year, but I can't make any guarantees or promises. So I would prefer that people are not sending me money monthly for not producing any content. The reasons for this have been given in some detail on the Telegram channel, as well as on the Subscribestar, Substack, and Patreon channels. But in short, I owe it to my family to dedicate more of my time to our financial stability, really. I'm also stretched very thin with regards to creative pursuits. I've got a lot of obligations on this summer, musical, religious, and otherwise. I've recently had to take on a new business as well. So I simply don't have time for the podcast. And the podcast does take a lot of time. And as much as I enjoy doing it and do very much hope to return to it, for the next few months, I just need to take a break from it. So I thank you very much, all of the guests and listeners that this podcast has had. And the Telegram channel will remain open. I'll probably post voice notes here and there. There will be posts and things offering, you know, useful thoughts, advice, news, things like that. For now, episode number 33 is the last one. Yeah, let's call it the last one in series one. And I think it's a very fitting episode to end on. I'm very proud, particularly of these two episodes that Adam and I have done, breaking down the symbology of my book, Fire in the White Stone. So with that said, let's go and uncover the answer to the riddle from the last episode for the last time for now. So riddle number 32, the answer to that one was, of course, ship. And I did offer a guess at that one in the last episode as well. It's quite an obvious one, really, that one. Decorated with rare ornaments, an experienced traveller grinding against the gravel, journeys most rapidly, the rolling sea has many ribs. Yeah, you know, you get the picture. That one was ship, so I shan't read out another riddle for this episode. We'll, you know, when the podcast picks back up, we'll start the riddles again. As for myself, I'm going to board my own ship and sail west to the shores of Valinor, the Undying Lands. So thank you very much to everyone who has listened, supported, shared, donated, anything that you've done. I'm very, very grateful. And the archive of episodes will remain up at fergen.com, F-Y-R-G-E-N.com. It will remain up on Spotify, on Odyssey. You can still listen to all of the episodes. So if you've missed any, then, you know, this might be the opportunity to catch up on them. The information in them, I pride myself on the fact that it is quite timeless. So I don't think any of it will age. The guests have been brilliant. I'd like to think that, you know, most of the ideas that I've shared have been of value. So until next time, later in the year, be well.